Today is Tuesday, May 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. As fighting continues between Israel and Hamas in the Gaza Strip, the death toll climbs.
It's about 200 people that have been killed, 59 of them children. In Israel, it's still 10 people.
Turkey is threatening to go ahead with Russian military purchases despite warnings from Washington.
Last month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Turkey could face sanctions if it bought other Russian weaponry.
We'll have these stories and more next. Israel pummeled Gaza with airstrikes on Monday, and Palestinian militants launched rockets at Israeli cities. The fighting continues despite a flurry of U.S. and regional diplomacy that has so far failed to halt more than a week of deadly conflict. Reporter Orly Halpern is in Jerusalem and provided me with this update.
The numbers in Gaza are rising. Israel is pounding the Gaza Strip. So far, it's about 200 people that have been killed, 59 of them children. In Israel, it's still 10 people, and the rockets are still coming down in Israel. There was one building that was hit, a direct hit today in the southern part of the country, in the city of Ashkelon. But compared to Gaza, buildings are being hit all the time, and hence you have thousands of people that are injured and 200 people who are killed. So the situation is very bad in Gaza. There's a problem because Israel, since May 10th, is not allowing, it's closed the borders. So fuel has not entered the strip. And there's almost no electricity, running water. It depends on also electricity to operate the pumps. So there's little running water. There's fuel supplies are low. And you have about 10,000 refugees, people whose homes have been demolished or partially, making them uninhabitable. Some of those people are staying at UN schools in the Gaza Strip. They've been converted into shelters. And the situation is quite dire, not to mention that there's corona. So you have hospitals that have corona patients, and there are people out with corona. So it's a very difficult situation in Gaza, in particular, right now.
Orly, on Sunday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate ceasefire. The United States and other countries are also calling on both sides to de-escalate. And the images of the bombing taking place in Gaza are going out around the world. And a lot of people have expressed an enormous amount of concern about the death of children. What I wanted to ask you is, how are Israelis responding to the calls for ceasefire and the reports of children being killed in the conflict?
You know, I spoke with some Israeli friends today, and they said, well, you can't compare. You simply can't compare. The killing of those people and of those children, the ones that are not are military activists, it was an accident, and accidents happen. They don't see that as a reason to stop firing on the Gaza Strip. And in fact, today there were calls by mayors of councils in the south of the country around the Gaza Strip, Israeli councils, who said, you know, they called on the government to just continue and to eradicate terror and to harm Hamas. Now, those are very vague demands. I mean, what does eradicate terror mean? There's a whole other aspect to this. You know, there's all sorts of needs on both sides that need to be resolved, and particularly in the Gaza Strip, which is still under occupation. So, you know, you can say eradicate terror, but if the people there are suffering, there's going to be, it's going to come back on Israel. So right now, Israelis are okay, for the most part, with continuing the attacks on Gaza. From the Israeli point of view, they're saying, well, they keep shooting on us, so we need to keep shooting on them. Even though Hamas has asked numerous times for a ceasefire, and there have been all these attempts, which Israel has rejected, Israelis still see Hamas as being responsible.
Orly Halpern reports from Jerusalem. with the fiercest regional hostilities in years showing no signs of abating, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken urged all sides to protect civilians. Washington, Egypt, and U.N. mediators stepped up diplomatic efforts, and the U.N. General Assembly will meet on Thursday to discuss the violence. The cross-border hostilities have been accompanied by an uptick of violence in the occupied West Bank and by riots involving Arab and Jewish mobs within Israel and clashes in Jewish-Arab communities. Police said an Israeli man died in a hospital on Monday after being attacked by Arab rioters last week. Elsewhere, Turkey is threatening to go ahead with Russian military purchases despite warnings from Washington. The threat comes as the impasse between the NATO members deepens over Ankara's purchase of a Russian missile system. Dorian Jones is up next.
With Washington stepping up its pressure on Ankara to reverse its purchase of the Russian S-400 missile defense systems, Turkish Defense Minister Hulusi Akar this month defended its intentions, dismissing American concerns. This is not an offensive system, Akar said, adding, this system can't threaten anyone in any way where it is deployed. It's not a risk, threat, or danger to anyone, the official said. Washington says the S-400 missile's advanced radar poses a threat to NATO defense systems and calls for its removal. But Ankara has said it's considering purchasing more batches of the Russian missiles. One source close to the government says Turkey has already struck a deal with Moscow. Last month, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Turkey could face sanctions if it bought other Russian weaponry, including additional S-400 missiles. Missile systems. Concerns over the S-400 have already resulted in Washington's blocking Turkey from modernizing its aging combat aircraft with America's advanced F-35. But Turkish presidential adviser Mesut Çavuşoğlu warns Washington is forcing Turkey only further to deepen its military ties with Russia.
We need 200 combat aircraft. This is the reality on the table. But the U.S. don't give the combat aircraft. And you pressure to buy the Russian combat aircraft. We don't want to buy it. But if the U.S. don't give the combat aircraft, we can buy the Russian combat aircraft. Because we need the combat aircraft.
Analysts predict Ankara will not make any new Russian weapon purchases until a planned meeting between the Turkish and American presidents on the sidelines of next month's NATO summit. İlham Özgel, an international relations analyst who writes for the Duvar news portal, says the Russian missile purchase is holding U.S.-Turkish relations hostage.
It's standing there as a stumbling block, and it's a kind of a precondition that the U.S. imposes on Turkey. And I haven't seen any other period in Turkish foreign policy history that Turkey has cornered itself to that extent.
Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said Washington should get over its objections, standing firm that Turkey would not reverse its Russian missile purchase. But some analysts predict that Ankara could yet be willing to make a deal if Washington offers concessions. Dorian Jones for VOA News. Istanbul.
French President Emmanuel Macron kicked off a two-day summit on Monday. The first day was dedicated to investment and debt relief for Sudan, while the Tuesday meetings are to address debt relief and overall support to COVID-19-hit African economies. Lisa Bryant has the details.
France says it will cancel $5 billion in debt Sudan owes it, and Germany also offered assistance during back-to-back Paris financing summits targeting Khartoum's democratic transition and Africa's economic rebound from the coronavirus pandemic. For VOA, Lisa Bryant has more from Paris. Text. The 2 days of high-level talks near the Eiffel Tower in Paris gather more than a dozen African leaders, along with top representatives of multilateral institutions, the European Union and China.
Dette que nous avons hérité, nous les jeunes.
Sudan was on Monday's agenda 2 years after overthrowing longtime leader Omar al-Bashir. The country faces a raft of challenges, as Sudanese activists like Nasreen el-Saim noted in speeches, among them inflation topping 300% and shortages of basic goods. A big chunk of its $60 billion in foreign debt is owed to the so-called Paris Club of major creditors.
Une singularité de votre transition.
President Emmanuel Macron hailed Sudan's transition toward democracy as inspirational, saying the international community was on its side and that the country needed to be supported economically and politically. Sudanese Prime Minister Abdallah Hamdok says a country rich in natural resources isn't looking for grants or donations, but rather wants the international community to explore investment opportunities. Africa-wide talks Tuesday focus on the economic fallout of COVID-19 that has decimated tourism and other sectors. Last year, the continent fell into its first recession in more than three decades. The World Bank estimates roughly 34 million new poor people living on less than $2 a day in sub-Saharan Africa alone. Experts say COVID-19 has left the continent facing a $300 billion financing shortfall. Ahead of the talks, International Monetary Fund head Kristalina Georgieva told France 24 TV she hopes richer nations will use a planned $650 billion boost in IMF's reserves to help the region power ahead.
We do hear a great deal of concern among the advanced economies of this dangerous divergence. Advanced economies pulling out, low-income countries falling further behind. Why this is not only an ethical concern, it is also an economic concern, because this divergence would mean more insecurity, more instability, and lost opportunities for the world economy to grow.
Oxfam International is also worried Africa is falling behind for somewhat different reasons. Peter Kamalingin, Oxfam's Pan-Africa Program Director, says giving Africa access to COVID-19 vaccines and technology is key.
The second thing, of course, is we are seeing quite a lot of the conditions that the IMF and the World Bank are continuing to give, the conditions on the loans. I think it is yielding into a lot of austerity, and that means a lot, particularly for the vulnerable parts of the population.
The summit, attended by leaders from Rwanda, Mozambique, and Egypt, is also seen as another chance for Paris to broaden its influence beyond Francophone Africa. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. According to the COVID-19 tracker from Johns Hopkins University, India has just shy of 25 million confirmed cases of the novel coronavirus, and second only to the United States in terms of the total number of confirmed cases. Some 90,000 Indian doctors are armed with medical degrees from countries like Russia, China, and Ukraine, and they're urging the government to put them to work in the battle against COVID-19 instead of standing idly by waiting for local licenses. Nowhere in the world has been hit harder by the pandemic than India, as a new variant of the virus fueled a surge in infections that has risen to more than 400,000 a day, coupled with more than 4,000 deaths each day, that has overwhelmed the health system. Britain lifted many of its coronavirus lockdown restrictions on Monday as infection rates have fallen to their lowest level since August. But as Henry Ridgewell reports, there are growing concerns over the spread of new mutations of the virus first seen in India.
Off on vacation, these British passengers arriving in Lisbon, Portugal, were among the first to take advantage of the easing of lockdown rules Monday. Among them was Matthew Bolden.
Oh, this is fantastic. The feeling is unbelievable.
A dozen countries have been put on Britain's green list for travel. Travellers from other countries, including most of Europe and the United States, still face mandatory quarantine on arrival in Britain. Not every everyone is enthusiastic about the changes. Fueling the concerns is the spread of a mutation of the coronavirus responsible for the surge in cases in India. The city of Bolton is a hotspot. The government has deployed mobile vaccination units and has warned that the spread of the new variant could disrupt plans to end all lockdown restrictions next month. Scientists say Britain is well prepared for opening up. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
However, as vaccine demand drops in the United States, the Biden administration says that it will share millions of COVID-19 vaccinations with the world. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that part of the story.
The U.S. had already pledged to ship 60 million AstraZeneca doses overseas once federal regulators clear them for use. Now, President Biden says 20 million doses of the three vaccines that are approved will be shared for the first time.
We need to help fight the disease around the world to keep us safe here at home and to do the right thing of helping other people.
He's been under growing international pressure to share doses, even as fewer Americans seek the shots domestically. More than 123 million people here are now fully vaccinated. More than 157 million have received at least one dose. Sagar Magani, Washington.
South Africa launched a new phase of its vaccination program this week, rolling out vaccines to those over the age of 60. Anita Powell has more.
The work begins in earnest now, with South Africa launching its second phase of vaccinations. Starting Monday, the vaccine will be rolled out to those over 60 years old. Health Minister William Kiese said the nation expects to receive more than 1.3 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine by the end of the month.
It is, of course, with great pleasure that we, as members of the National Health Council, wish to give some details to the public about the mass vaccination campaign that will kick off tomorrow. We know that everyone has been very anxious to know what will happen tomorrow and how we will start to vaccinate our most vulnerable citizens and then move on to vaccinating the general population.
Those over 40 years of age will be eligible for vaccines in July, and everyone over the age of 18 will be eligible in November. The government hopes to have 40 million people, the estimated number to achieve herd immunity, vaccinated by February 2022. South Africa's vaccination campaign has had some major setbacks as the nation reversed course on plans to use the AstraZeneca vaccine after studies indicated it might not be fully effective against the variant of the virus that is dominant in South Africa. Sharon Flint is the nursing manager for 15 Johannesburg area elder care homes with about 4,500 residents. While she agreed that the nation's vaccine rollout took longer than she had hoped, she said she's glad it's ramping up now.
We thought this was only going to happen much, much later in the year, so to have started it today is very exciting, and we're in regular contact with the Department of Health because they're going to be actually coming to the homes and the care centres for Methodist homes and all the other homes in South Africa. And we've trained our nurses in vaccinating, so we've got our sites ready. We've got all the equipment we need ready. Now we're just waiting for the government to give us dates. And they have started this week, so it's very, very exciting.
She said it has been a tough year for her residents. Some have succumbed to the virus. She declined to give numbers. And the rest have struggled because of restrictions that keep them from seeing their loved ones in person. Flint is in that situation herself. Her 92-year-old mother is in a care facility. We asked her what her plan is once her mother is fully vaccinated.
I'm going to take her out for breakfast. She can have chocolate for breakfast if she wants to. She can do whatever she loves. Just put my arms around her and hug her. So I think it's going to be such a celebration.
That scene is likely to be repeated, with or without the chocolate, across the Rainbow Nation in coming months, as South Africa's elderly get this essential protection. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
A deadly cyclone made landfall on India's west coast Monday, further exacerbating the country's crisis battling the coronavirus pandemic. Cyclone Tauktae prompted mass evacuations and the halting of vaccination campaigns in the western state of Gujarat, where it made landfall with sustained winds of up to 165 kilometers per hour, according to the country's meteorological department. The storm killed over a dozen people even before it made landfall, and local media report that it is the worst cyclone to hit the area in 30 years. Indian media also reported that at least six people were killed in the state of Maharashtra, home to the country's financial hub of Mumbai. Thousands of rescue ships and aircraft were deployed as fishing boats along the coast came back to shore. But lockdowns throughout the country in place to quell the spread of the coronavirus may delay some rescue operations. The storm is expected to further delay India's embattled response to the coronavirus. After last year's Eurovision Song Contest was canceled amid the global COVID-19 pandemic, it's roaring back to life with coronavirus bubbles added to its heady mix of music and camp. Bands and singers from 39 countries are competing in the Dutch port city of Rotterdam for the coveted title that can be a springboard to a global career or a fleeting taste of fame. Thousands of fans will be allowed to watch rehearsals, semifinals, and the final on Saturday if they test negative for the coronavirus. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The World Health Organization reports the COVID-19 pandemic has set back years of gains made in efforts to eliminate neglected tropical diseases, a diverse group of 20 illnesses that disproportionately affect impoverished communities in tropical areas. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
Neglected tropical diseases affect 1.7 billion people globally. 40% are in Africa, a continent that encompasses most of the 10 high-burden countries in the world. Over the past decade, the World Health Organization reports great progress has been made in the treatment of many of these life-threatening and debilitating diseases. It notes 42 countries around the world have eliminated at least one disease. However, Muele Chele Malichela, director of WHO's Department of Control of Neglected Tropical Diseases, says she fears a lot of this good work could be undone because of the negative impact of COVID-19. She says the pandemic has caused disruptions and delays in NTD services. She says mass treatment campaigns, surveys of affected areas, and the transport and delivery of medicines have been interrupted.
All the efforts that have been done to control these neglected tropical diseases to bring about elimination in some of the countries will be reversed if the focus is not kept, a good focus on surveillance, a good focus on continued interventions in some of the countries which are nearing elimination.
WHO reports guinea worm disease is on the cusp of eradication, with only 27 human cases reported in six African countries last year. In 1986, about 3.5 million human cases occurred annually in 21 countries in Africa and Asia. WHO says yaws, a chronic skin infection, is a disease that can be eradicated in the Indian subcontinent. Malichela cites several other success stories.
In terms of elimination of trachoma, we have Morocco, we have Ghana, and more recently we have Gambia. We have the elimination of lymphatic filariasis in Togo and in Malawi. In Yemen, which is, you know, outside Africa in the Middle East, they have eliminated lymphatic filariasis under very difficult conditions, but they've managed to do it. And that's, you know, very impressive feat.
At the end of January, WHO formally launched a new roadmap aimed at driving progress toward a world free of NTDs by 2030. Health officials consider the roadmap a key piece in ensuring countries build back better after COVID-19 by focusing on resilience and strengthening health systems. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The importance of having a digital skill set in today's world of the internet and social media has become more critical than ever for employees and employers alike. In Nigeria, for example, the demand for digital skills is at an all-time high. Africa 54's Paul Ndiho spoke with Omo Clark, the founder and CEO of IBEZ via Skype. IBEZ is a digital products agency specializing in web and software application development and training in Lagos, Nigeria.
You've been in the technology sector for a while. You do software development and a lot more. Let's start there.
Basically, what I do is build software solutions, software products, you know. So I run a digital products agency. We say we build for ourselves, but not really. We build for our community, and then we build for businesses as well.
Is software development a big business in Nigeria?
Software development in Nigeria is still, what I would say, in its infancy. You know, we're just, we're we're not there yet, if I call you that. It is big, software is big business, because obviously a lot of companies' businesses run on software solutions, you know. So from that perspective, software development market is really, really huge, you know, put it that way. But do we build it ourselves then? So that's the other part of it.
What kind of software do you build for your clients? Do you even build the hardware to go along with that software, or it's just a software development?
We focus on software. So we don't touch hardware, you know, too much. We can advise on it and consult. From, you know, I mean, there's a lot of people, a lot of businesses don't understand tech. So we can advise on that, but we build software solutions. So the kinds of things that we've typically built, we've built for different companies across industries. So we're not like focused on fintech or focused on something like that. We build across board. So we've built for, the first thing that came to my mind, health tech. You know, we build for hospitals, dentists, you know, different sorts of applications to help them do their business better, help customers communicate, reach them better. We've built for education institutions, you know. We've built for, I mean, you name it. We've built for travel, for businesses in the travel industry. We've built for NGOs, you know. We've built for charity organizations. All across, we've done work for the with the government as well.
Most businesses were affected by the coronavirus pandemic. I'm just curious, at what extent was your business affected by this global shutdown and the pandemic?
From that perspective, in my business, we got a lot of work, you know, a lot of businesses wanting to get online, get websites, start selling online, doing all of that. We got that. But on the flip side of it, because of like infrastructural challenges we have in Nigeria, we were impacted. Yes, we saw a lot of work. I was busy throughout the lockdown working, doing a specific thing, i.e. building really web applications for people, helping them get online so they can work, so they can sell, reach their customers and all that. And doing training, you know, so we're training people on digital skills, training all these businesses that never really used the internet before, training them on digital marketing skills. But on the flip side, our capacity was limited, you know, because I had staff that didn't have power to work from home. They didn't have the ability to work from home. So we could only take on so much work.
Nigeria has become sort of a go-to place for software development. All these international tech giants are running to Nigeria, especially Lagos, where you are. What seems to attract these international companies to come to Lagos, to tap into the talent there?
I think the fintech space in Nigeria is vibrant. You know, a lot of fintech companies like Flutterwave, you've heard of them, Paystack, they're doing so well. So, and there's this huge talent pool, you know. We have a youth population in Nigeria, so many young people in Nigeria trying to do stuff. So I think that's an attractive market.
Besides being a software developer, you also created a company that brings young, talented people together. Speak more to that.
In Nigeria, it's difficult to get handymen, you know, competent ones to come and do stuff for you. And it's a general problem that affects everybody in Nigeria, really. Everybody has an artisan story. So what we do is we register tradespeople, people, I think somebody coined the phrase, that work in the informal sectors, often forgotten, often neglected, many reasons behind that. You can go and say, I'm looking for a plumber in Ikoyi, in Lagos, you know, to come and do stuff. And it shows you all the people that have registered, and then you can come. So it's a huge ongoing stuff we're doing, but it's really to organize, digitize that market so that people can, you know what I mean? It's a two things. So they can get jobs because they have problems getting work, and you, whoever is sitting in your homes, in their offices, can find somebody quickly.
That was iBiz founder and CEO Omo Clark speaking to Africa 54's technology correspondent, Paul Ndiho. And finally, Australia's oldest ever man shares some secrets for a long life, and the AP's Ed Donahue takes us home.
Dexter Kruger is a retired cattle rancher and lives in the Pinneroo Aged Care Center in Queensland.
He's probably one of the sharpest residents here. His memory is amazing for an 111-year-old.
Melanie Calvert works at the center. Dexter Kruger told Australian Broadcasting a weekly poultry delicacy has contributed to his longevity.
Chicken brains.
You know, chickens have a head, and in there there's a brain. And they are delicious little things. There's only one little bite.
Kruger is writing his autobiography.
I've written 300 stories, and they were all packed in my mind, gathered over 100 years.
The oldest ever woman in Australia lived until she was 114. I'm Ed Donahue.
And that's going to do it for us. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.